Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's now time for our interview specials. Take a trip back in time to the golden era of football. Sit back and listen up. It's time for the main event with the Phoenix Five and a 90s football icon. On this week's show, we have Mr. Rule Fox. Ladies and gentlemen, sit back and enjoy the show.
You can't win anything with kids.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
How much are the players looking forward to Arsene Wenger arriving?
On this week's Phoenix Five, we have a very special guest joining us, a superstar of the 90s football and one of the great players to make it into an underrated 11.
Flick on Owen. And it's Fox. Rule Fox has equalised. It's Fox again. 2-2.
Fox with a shot. Oh, and Fox scores. Well, that was a good finish from
Kareen. Fox! Goalkeeper's heroics in vain.
He had played 395 games and scored 49 goals. He played with some legends of the game, including Andrew Cole, Ginola, Beardsley, Sheringham and Sutton. He made his senior debut for Norwich City during the 86-87 season, later moving on to the Great Entertainers in 94, and then signed by Jerry Francis at Spurs in 95. Finally ending his career at West Bromwich Albion. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you Mr. Rule Fox. Hi, Rule. How are you today?
Not too bad. I hope you're well.
Yeah, good. Thank you again for coming on the show, mate. Really appreciate the help and the support you've given. Just going to go over a few questions. Everyone's got a few questions. I'm going to start off this week with Miller. You had a question for Rule. Let's get started with you.
Hi, Rule.
How you doing?
I'm going to go back to the beginning where it all started for you, really, and going back to the youth systems. What's your views on the changes from the YTS to the academy? And do you think it's good for the game? And are the youth getting the right foundations?
I think technically wise and the education they're getting is very good. But what I do see is that the chances you get of getting into a first team setting are quite rare. I mean, the setup when I had it, I'm probably biased, but I think a lot of people in my ear would agree. It was a better setup because it was a case where you learn the ropes, you learn to be a grown up. You were integrated into your youths. And there from then, you served your apprenticeship, which meant you probably done a bit of college work during the week. You cleaned boots. You know, you done all the dirty work after you've done your training. So it kind of bedded you well. So you kind of integrate with your other youth players and also with the senior players. And I think maybe, as we all know, money's become such a big thing now. And with money, what happens with a lot of these players, I'm not saying all of the players, but there's no drive. You know, there's nothing to look forward to because, you know, everyone knows that playing football, you're going to earn a lot of money. But if there's no targets for you as a young player and you know, you're not even getting in the first team, but you're financially comfortable, you know, there's nothing there to drive you on. So I'm not saying that we're all players, but I think you get disheartened if you're not getting to a first team. You got to remember, if you're at a first team now with the amount of pressure there is at clubs, you know, they could go buy a £20 million player or £30 million player in your position. So the chances you get in the first team, unless you've got a manager who believes in you, it's very difficult in today's game.
Yeah, perfect. Appreciate that.
We spoke about it before, the money in football has changed massively in terms of the youth setup and paying your dues, so to speak. As you said, you know, the idea was you started at a club at 13, 14, you saw the first reserves, then you got into the academy or what is now the academy, which is the youth setup, and then you clean boots. You know, you get the bullying culture, obviously, could have gone out of hand with some clubs. But your experience, from what I've looked in, is you have quite a good experience at your YTS system. Is that fair in saying?
I mean, I went through the same thing. I mean, I would say got bullied. I mean, I was the only black player in my team, so I got a little bit of stick here and there, racially abused here and there. But there, we had quite a good setup, so there were people to speak to, and I also had one friend who lived locally to me. He was the one who helped me get the trial. So he was playing in the first team then, a guy called Louis Donowa. So I could always go to him if I felt that, you know, I was being ill-treated by other members of the youth team or anything. But I could look after myself, even though I was small. I had a bit of a big mouth on me. So I wasn't that really afraid of stuff like that. But it was prevalent then, you know, there was a lot of that going on. But there weren't so much bullying from from the first team and stuff like that, you know. It was just part of growing up. You know, you couldn't be cheeky. You couldn't walk into the first team's changing rooms and just bowl in there and start having a conversation. You know, you had to knock on the door, you know, then they'll let you in. And maybe they would, you know, bung you in the shower some days or throw you in. But that was just all banter. You know, if you came out of there and then they've been slapping you about or something, you come out there like you've just won the lottery. You say, yeah, I've just been slapped about. It was great. They threw me in the shower. It was brilliant. You know, some away trips I can remember, you know, away games, even when I was quite fortunate. I mean, my progression went quite quickly. So by about 17, I was travelling with the first team just for experience, you know. And even with them, they would be pulling stunts on me and, you know, things like away games. They kept, you know, encouraging me to have a beer because I never drunk. So I'd be getting drunk, you know, in the back of the coach. And then all of a sudden, I'll be going to the toilet. And I remember one stage, I got knocked in the toilet from Man City all the way back to Norwich. They locked me in the toilet. So all these kind of things was just part and parcel of it, you know. So there was good times, but obviously there was some difficult times. But, you know, it moved on quite quickly once I got in the first team.
What part of the change from YCS to Academy do you think should still be in for the youth today?
I think everything that I've grown up with. I mean, you could speak to any player from my era, you know, you could speak to anyone. I'll guarantee 99% of them would say, what would you change about the youth set up in academies? And they would probably say they'd love to take them back to our era when it was YTS, because you had to work. You know, that, you know, there was a carrot put in front of you. I said, well, if you do this, you'll get this. If, you know, if you're playing well for the youth team, you get your progression into the reserves. If you play good for the reserves, you'll travel with the first team as experience. You know, there's not a lot of managers do that. I might be for the pressure of that, but you look at the academies now. I mean, I get asked so many times off people about, oh, I've got a young boy, you know, he's scoring all these goals. He's only 14. You know, they're asking to sign him. And the first thing I'll say to which they're very surprised, I'll say to them, well, just let him enjoy his football. Because the percentage of kids now who get released before they even leave school, and it's devastating for them. We talk about mental health for kids and all that. You know, it's probably everyone's dream. You live through your son sometimes if you haven't played at that level. So when you take them to, like, I'm local from Ipswich, so I get a lot of people come through for advice and say, oh, my son's in this academy. But then I hear the same stories that I'd say a very, very low percentage of them players who start from maybe under nines, you won't hear from them again getting into the youth setup or anything. It'd be a very small amount. And sometimes that they might miss out because they haven't matured enough. They might have the ability, but the coaching isn't there. It's almost like you've got to tick certain boxes in these academies. Now, you've got to be a certain height. You've got to be able to run so far. You know, you've got to weigh a certain way. And there's a lot of pressure on these things. But I think a lot of these youth academies as well use that as a financial gain. It's not nice to hear, but I feel a lot of them, you're endorsing with their kits. Some of these academies make you actually drive your children up to away games once you get to that higher level. So you're forking out all these finances, and then they get to 15 and they've been told, so all the years, 6 years they've been in the academy, and they've been telling them every year, yep, you're doing well. All of a sudden at 16, it's like, sorry, we don't think it's good enough. But there's no, what can I say? There's no afterthought about saying, well, hold on a minute. We're letting this lad go, but he must be good enough to play at a lower level or something. There should be a link between these clubs to say, well, if you can't play for a Man United, there might be a Brentford or someone else or a lower club where they've probably got a little bit more time to give him that education and, you know, give him that patience that he needs. Mm.
Brilliant. Anything else, Miller? Are you happy with that?
Yeah, answered everything. And pretty much the same views from me. I think that's missing in today's game is the foundation that the youth system and the YTS, cleaning boots, change of rooms, the respect showing the first team. I think that's missing, and it's holding back certain players, not all players, not all the young players, talent that's coming through. I think it's holding a lot of them back because they've not got the right attitude, drive and respect for their peers.
Yeah, but also, I agree with you there, because I think what happens, a lot of players, I mean, the days of, like we were saying about players who were probably what we call raw players, like I was just playing for my Sunday league team when I got spotted, and it was easier for us then. I mean, we can remember every 6 week line, we were allowed to write off the football clubs, and the majority of the time, the football club would invite you for a trial, and you didn't have to have any specific experience or anything. You think of the players like Ian Wright, who started late, who was picked up quite late. He was playing for his local team, Les Ferdinand. There was a lot of players from my era who didn't go for any academies or something. They were just raw talent. But what helped them is they had a manager who believed them and put the work in with them. Where, like I agree with you, the academies now, it's almost like as soon as they're there, they think they've made it. And they've been put into their head, you know, got all the kits, got all the lovely stuff. Some of these parents are financially well off, because they think they're such a good talent that what they'll do, they'll financially give families, you know, a little bonus to say, yeah, if he signs for us at 15, you know, we'll make sure we look after him. But then as soon as he gets to that academy, they're always left to their own. Or what ends up happening, they can't trust these young players because managers are under so much pressure. So what do? They start loading them out. Mm. And then you'll find you've got most of your youth set up. Chelsea have been relevant for until Frank Lampard. But they had about, say, like 20-odd, they're youth players, a reserve player out on loan.
They have 53 players out on loan 2 seasons ago.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. That's a business. That's not football, is it? That's a business. You know, and we're seeing now that they've been given a chance, like your Mounts and a few other players, and James was in there. You know, they've got the youth players in that are now shining. But they could have been shining probably, what, 2-3 seasons ago. But again, because of the pressures of having to win and the finances and the business platform of it, they haven't got time to develop players. But, you know, you need to be brave. And that's why I felt sorry for Frank Lampard, because he was brave. You know, he might not have got... I don't think his problem was the youth players. I think it's the senior players. I think the senior players were the ones who probably didn't buy into what he was doing.
Because senior players that have done the other managers before him.
Yeah, yeah. You look at now, why is it all of a sudden now they're pulling up trees? Same players, you know. Sometimes you got to look a little bit deeper than it's just Frank Lampard. Sometimes you got to remember Frank's probably played against a lot of them senior players. They're around his age, so all of a sudden Frank Lampard be telling them they're not doing their job right. There's a little bit of resentment comes in there. They won't admit it, but there is.
I think that's a really good point in terms of the money in football. I'm good. Just obviously 92. Obviously Sky came over and took over. Well, created this whole. Not bubble, because a bubble burst.
Yeah.
I think bubble it's so big now, it's never going to burst. I think it'll plateau. But wages back in sort of 92, 92 and definitely up to about 97, 98 in terms of the package of a player would receive in wages was quite decent, obviously, not compared to now in hindsight.
Yeah.
But it was a lot more bonus related back in the days. You know, when I've read biographies or books or Anything that's about the game in the mid-90s was all about, you get a set contract for, I don't know, $8,000-$9,000 a week maybe, and then you get a bonus for goals, appearances, winning things, which then, as you said earlier about the young players that dangling that carrot, surely that was, as a business model, that was a way to run a business. What was your views on the changes that?
Yeah, it worked for us. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. We had incentives all the time. So, for instance, player for Norwich, we got bonuses for how many games we didn't lose. So if we won, you know, X amount of games in a row, our bonuses would keep going up and going up. So sometimes when we had that run where we were in the top five most of the season, our bonuses were more than our wages. So for us, it was like every time we won a game, we didn't care about the wages. We'd like, oh, we got another bonus. Sometimes we're going on a run of five games and our bonus is like $2,000 just for a win. So for us, and you imagine once we got to the Champions League, then the bonuses went up because once we negotiated the contract, the chairman never thought, oh, they ain't going to get no, they're not going to get the Champions League. They're never going to win the league. So our bonuses of being in the top six was crazy. And once we got to that top six, you could see the chairman every week was just sweating. Because, do you know what I mean? Because every week he's thinking, oh, God, not another bonus. So most of the time, like I said, our wages, I'll say only like two, I'm working for that much. It was sad. I think it was highest player was probably on about $4,000 a week, which is still good for them days because that's when the Premier first started, you know. So, and then you the signing on fee would be a lot bigger. You're talking four figures, five figures, you know, your sign on fee every year. So, with that, you actually weekly wage was probably around a 4,000 or 5,000. But then what you used to get signing on fee bonus was more than your wages. So they like to give out lump sums. Maybe it's a financial way they did it. But then our signing on fees and our bonuses, you know, outdid what we was earning as wages anyway.
That's the thing. I think they get, the players get silly money per week and then they get silly money for bonuses. But it's hard to incentivize a millionaire. You know, if you're on 50, 80, 90, 100 grand a week as a standard wage, and then you're getting 7 million per year to sign on, and then you're getting, I don't know, a 50 grand clean sheet bonus and all that. It's just the incentive isn't there because they're already multimillionaires. But do you think we had an episode last week about the controversies in football. And one thing that came up was our number one was the Bosman ruling. Do you think that had the biggest impact on wages, allowing people to run down their contracts?
Yeah, because I think once that ruling came in, then people could see incentive to make themselves money. Because like we're saying, in them days, even though people were saying that the money was good, it was only for the elite lot. You know, you had your elite players, you know, I think only we started to get an influx of the foreign players coming over and they were commanding big wages. So the actual players who were, what we say, were established local players who were the team, the money wasn't that, the money was decent, don't get me wrong. The money was decent, but compared to the influx of the foreign players, they're the ones who helped get the money up. Because as soon as that Bosman came as well, people had just let their contracts run down. And, you know, they were allowed to almost save a club the signing on fee. So if you was going, for instance, if I was going, you know, to Newcastle, I went to Newcastle, I let my contract run down, I could have then negotiated and say, listen, you know, I've saved you $2.5 million. Or whatever the price is, so you can negotiate some of that signed on fee. You know, and I think who else done that? I think Sol Campbell done it when I was at Tottenham when he went to Arsenal. Don't forget his contract ran out. So once he went over across to Arsenal, which you probably don't like to hear about, but
I love it. I love it, Rolf.
He's an Arsenal fan.
I know, yeah. But when he went over there, so you think all that investment Tottenham had in him. And don't forget, he probably repaid him for his performances. But to see him go somewhere there and they could get a fee for him. So Sol was probably at his peak. I'd say he was probably worth, I think players were going around the 20, 30 million in them times, weren't they? So if he negotiates it right, he probably would have said to them, well, you know, instead of you having to pay the 30 million, I've saved you, give me that as a one-off bonus. He won't get the whole lot, but, you know, you can negotiate. And then he's then got to still sort out his wages. Man. So the Bosman was brilliant. For players, you know,
madness, wasn't it? You went on about the season you was in the top six with Norwich. So in the 92-93 season, you were 3 points clear at Christmas. Did you ever think at that stage, was it? It's on. We've got a chance here.
No. I'll be honest with you. Do you know what it was? It was strange because it was almost like the few seasons back with the Leicester situation. It was like, oh, you're going to slip up soon. You're going to blow up soon. And every time we did lose a game, we always kind of won the game after. And we would probably, you know, sometimes it'd be 3-0 down and bring it back to 3-3. I mean, we had a team who were, I would say, we got so used to just going out and enjoying our football. We had a manager in Mike Walker, who, no disrespect to him, he was our goalkeeper coach. He was our goalkeeper coach. And then he, by default, became our first team manager. But don't get me wrong, he was a great manager. But he wasn't throwing teacups. He just let us go play football. And we had players who were probably myself. We were peaking at our feet. So you get to that stage in football, I think it's from around, I'll say around mid-20s. From your mid-20s, you'll have this peak, I would say, for 4 or 5 years where just everything's just instinctive. You know, you're at your best of your fitness levels. Everything becomes just natural for you. And I think also we had a great influx of ex-Tottenham players. We always had this connection where we would get Tottenham players who weren't quite getting to the grade in the first team. I think we had, at one time, we had Mark Bowen, who was a fantastic player. We had Ian Crook, a brilliant centre midfield player. I think we had Ian Culverhouse, John Paulson. We had Gary Brooke there. We've had like Tottenham players who played the sort of football that we were brought up to play with. So when they all came into our team and played with us for maybe one season, with the players we had there already, you know, we had Mark Robbins from Norwich. We had, you know, Robert Fleck at one time, Dale Gordon, myself. It just became a thing where we had all these young players come through and they would get given a chance, like we talked about earlier, about young players given a chance. And when they were coming to the first team, it was all just fun. So when we go to playing every week, we weren't supposed to even get in the top 10, alone in the top 6. So once we actually got there, all we were talking about was the bonuses and enjoying the way games. We weren't doing anything specifically professional. You know, we were still having beers on a Friday night in our hotel room. We were staying up till 1 a.m. playing video games. So all that diet stuff didn't mean nothing. You know, we were just going out there enjoying ourselves, you know, and it just so happened that with that, we actually bonded better because we were all together all the time. So, you know, we never at one stage thought that we was going to win the title. But, you know, of course, there's been, you go along with the press and saying, oh, you've got half a chance. All you got, as soon as they told us all we got to do is win this game, so I think that's when the pressure kicked in with us. Because up until then, all we were gearing ourselves on, oh, they all think we're going to lose, so we'll just go out there and play. So we went out there with no fear. But then as soon as we were probably one of the favourites to win, I think then the pressure came on a little bit too much for us.
Was it true that Ajax made an approach to you after the end of that season? You turned them down?
Yeah, well, they came in for me about 3 times. They came in for me when I was a youth player. Because, again, in the youth days, at the end of the season, the first team went on to they called it end-of-season tour, but it was just a jolly-up. You know, you went out there, you played a few teams, exhibition games, but most of the time you was on a drink, you was just on a piss up. So with the youth team, we went to like tournaments playing against Ajax and all these other teams. So I remember I played in a tournament, I think it was in Holland, and I got playing a tournament and someone approached me after the tournament there, but our coach had a massive argument and they ended up fighting over it. They had me coach. Ended up fighting over it. I didn't look at anything bad. I just thought, oh, this guy's come over, went to give me his card and said, you know, how long have you got now? I think I was still at school. I was playing for the youth team. So I was only 15.
Wow.
So I hadn't actually signed youth team forms by then. So then obviously the guy must have knew it. So he said, oh, why don't you just come over here and come for a training? And I thought, oh, that's nice. Before I could actually answer, there was an arm come across my neck. He was fighting the IX guy. And it was all kicked off. And then ironically, that helped because when we got back, they signed me on at 15, 16. So yeah, they came for me then. And then when we had the run, they came in again just before Newcastle.
Were you not tempted to go then?
Well, at them days, we didn't really have relevant agents. And even though we had agents, it was almost... The only how you would know is if your chairman was upfront and honest with you. So it was either your chairman came and told you, or you had a dodgy agent. In them days, they were dodgy as hell, the agents. So you had a dodgy agent who took 30% off you for doing a deal. So I was a bit sceptical about agents. So what I only heard about it once I actually signed for Newcastle. But it's just one of those things, you know. At the end of the day, I mean, them or Newcastle, I probably might even have swayed to Newcastle because of Kevin Keegan factor and Terry McDermott. So
I'll bring you in, Grant. You had a question about Newcastle. Yeah. I'll give it to you, mate.
I have, yeah. Rob, just before I get on to my question, the Ajax thing, can I ask you, do you actually, at that time, it would have been mid-90s, do you regret not going to Ajax? Because that was the time when Ajax had that fantastic team that won the European Cup. You could have been a massive part of that. Does that ever cross your mind?
I'll be honest with you, I wasn't really too aware of them. It wasn't, obviously, everyone knew about Ajax and Cruyff and all the players, but I wasn't aware. We played them quite a few times in the youth tournaments when I was at Norwich. So I was aware of them, but we used to beat them in game C. So it wasn't kind of thing where I was thinking, quite like, you know, there was nothing that stood out for me. You know, even though I knew of Ajax, it wasn't where I was at Norwich, I was happy there. So it weren't a case where I was actually thinking, oh, you know, because Norwich only just gave me that chance. Don't forget, Norwich only just signed me from schoolboy. So it's only been the first time I came, it was only my second season, I was still at school, so everything was just like a blur for me at that time. But then obviously when in the Newcastle one, I would have probably have wanted to talk to him, but I didn't know until I've actually signed for Newcastle. So do you know, it's one of them things that, you know, if chance was there, because I'm one of them people, you know, I've proved it before, even though I was from Ipswich, I've traveled around, so I'm not afraid to travel and try new things. But unfortunately it was one of them ones that I wasn't aware of until I've actually, you know, till it was gone.
Okay. The question I had for you, Raul, is when you signed for Newcastle, at that time, Kevin Keegan hailed you as the best player. You was the best player in that position in the country. Did you find it strange that Graham Taylor never approached you to play for England at all? I personally do. I think it was a strange decision.
Yeah, I think especially with the type of football that we're playing and the form I was in. I mean, I think I was getting talked about just before I left for Norwich. And I think the only one who was probably in my place at that time was Tony Daly. And don't forget, Graham Taylor had Tony Daly, was winner at Aston Villa.
Yeah,
good player. Don't get me wrong, fantastic player. But I still felt maybe I still would have gave him a bit of competition and maybe I would have been, you know, in the squad. You know, and it never progressed. You know, they kept talking about it. I remember that I actually got a phone call from the FA, the England set up one time, to say how unlucky I was to miss out on the squad when I was at Norwich. And I thought, well, it's almost like a slap in the face, isn't it? Because it's almost like saying that you're doing well, but you're not doing well enough to get in the squad. And then once I went to Newcastle again, I was in the limelight because we were playing great football.
Yeah.
We're playing great football. Newcastle are playing well. And I think by then, Terry Venables took over in England. And I played two England B games. We had quite a good team. We had the types of Robbie Fowler in the team in England B and everything. So I got called up with Rob Lee and John Beresford, also at Newcastle. And we got two games. And then they kind of then stopped doing the B games. And then after that, I didn't hear nothing else from him. But you know, I'm grateful for, you know, it might be B internationals, but I've still got the caps there. So I'm proud that I got it, but I still felt like, you're right, I still felt maybe I could have got in more squads.
Yeah. The form you was in at that time, yeah, because Andy Sinton at QPR at the time, he kept getting called up as well. So I thought, you know, when you're looking back, quite harsh that you never got the actual chance, but...
Yeah, because you think about it, like I said to you, especially when you think, A lot of the football around them days was about form, you know. But there were still occasions where your form didn't really matter. If a manager had his eye on a certain player and he liked the type of player he is, then instead of giving another person a chance to see how they are, I'd prefer maybe to get a game. If I didn't perform in the training sessions or whatever, then I could quite understand, because the England setups are different now. They'll bring in youth players in just to train with them to see how they adapt. But that never happened. You know, he made his choice. You know, like you said, he had Andy Sinton was there. And don't forget, at the time, when Andy Sinton called up, I think it's at Sheffield Wednesday. And I can't remember if I was at Newcastle then, but he was getting called up in front of me. And so
was
Tony Daly still. So with that, it was almost a case where you kind of thought, well, my form's not doing out the door because I'm scoring goals and we're winning games. And my assist was probably top assist in the league as well. But, you know, it just so happened it just don't get picked. So, you just get on with it.
Yeah.
What was it like at Newcastle in terms of the training ground? Obviously, you was only there for a short period because Ginola came in, I think, the season after. But for the time you was at Newcastle on the training, how was Keegan to work with in terms of as a coach? Obviously, he's known for a very attacking style of football, and some players have just said it's kind of just go out there and train and play. How did you find it working under Keegan and McDermott?
It was brilliant for me because I'd gone from a Norwich team, don't forget, who were quite open and didn't have no fear, and that's why we finished where we were in the league. So I went from that setup to the same setup. When at Newcastle, he was just all about attacking, and it was bad for the defenders. But for myself, it was just he encouraged us just to keep playing and playing and playing and not giving up. And it was almost like he wanted you to play with a smile on your face. There was occasions where I used to get angry with myself. You know, you couldn't just get that pass across, and I'd hear him shouting across me at the pitch, saying, "Foxy, Foxy, Foxy," and I'll be like, "Oh God, what's he going to say? He's going to tell me off." And he'd be like, keep smiling, keep enjoying it." You know. So it encouraged you just to keep your joy in your football. It was only when the pressures of the finances came in, you know, that, you know, your persona changes, you know, because you're under pressure to win games. But, you know, my time, even though it was a short spell, it felt longer because of the amount of joy we had. When we first went there, we were training at a university called Durham, Durham University. So, you know, it's an open play. So you go there. And the training ground was lovely because we were training on the hockey grass and everything. So it was like glass. So, you know, imagine a football we're playing. We got Beardsley, Andy Cole, Robert Lee there. We got, you know, Lee Clark there. We had a lot of talented players. So the father side was just going mental. You know, the touches were, the football was brilliant. And then all of a sudden he decided he wanted to let the fans in. So there was times we had like 1,500, 2,000 fans at a training ground. You know, the fans were fanatical. But at the same time, they're respectful. So, you know, for the support there and the football, you know, you can see the troubles they're going through now, but they're still for the stadium. So my time there was so enjoyable. It was a pleasure, you know, because it was a difficult decision because even though they came in for me, the story behind it was that the chairman was the one who called me in when I was going to training and said to me, you know, come into my office before you go training. And I thought he's just offering me a brand new contract. And he said, "Look, Newcastle are coming for you. We've agreed the fee. We're going to let you go up there and talk to them." I still had 2 years to run on my contract. So I just thought, well, hold on, that's a bit strange. Why are you letting me talk? He said, "Look, we think that you can be a better player away from here. But if you still feel you want to stay, then you can stay." So I said, "Oh, I'll go up there and talk to him." So by the time I went up there, he'd gone and told the press that I turned the contract down. So in his back of his mind, he really wanted to get rid of me at Norwich because I think he wanted to cash in on the players, you know, which is a bit cheek. But at the end of the day, it got me from where I was. So I wasn't upset about it. But then when I went to Newcastle, and as soon as I spoke to Keegan, I mean, I met him in a hotel, I think it was like on a Tuesday, and I never went back home. I had to get my clothes set up. I didn't even go home to pick my stuff up. I was that happy there. You know, I was in a hotel. He just looks after you. It was like little things like, even though I was in a hotel for the first year, I was allowed to have all my family up in the hotel. My friends could stay in the hotel. You know, when my friends came up, they'll have a security guy take them out and take them for meals. So they took away the pressure of you know, trying to think about moving into a newer area. Don't forget, you know, again, going back to the, you know, how it was in football, Newcastle wasn't a place where I enjoyed playing because of the racism and stuff. So at the time, when he told me about the club setup, he said to me, you're going to change people's mindsets, which made it even more important for me to, you know, do well there because he was saying that not many black players have been successful there. They never really had any there to what they could laud about. So when Andy Cole had been there just the season before me, so it was just me and Andy Cole there, then obviously from there is, you know, the fans took to us straight away and you know, it's one of the best times of my career.
Amazing. You moved on to Spurs after Jerry Francis. Was it about 18 months later, I think it was, for £2.5 million? How was that with Jerry Francis? How did you get to that move? What happened with that?
Again, it was strange. It was almost like the Newcastle. It's almost like the Norwich situation. I'd been playing well at Newcastle. I scored 12 goals, 14 goals first season I was there. I was then playing well for the second season. Then he I think he then brought David Ginola in, which was fine. So we were playing either side. So that was working well. You know, we was I was playing all the time. And then he had the situation with Andy Cole. So then he sold Andy Cole but got Keith Gillespie in as part exchange. So then all of a sudden he's got a dilemma. He's got three of us who want to play, you know. And then he chopped in changes. I play 1 week, whatever week. And it just got to say, well, I felt that, well, hold on a minute. I don't think I'm going to be playing all the time. Which, again, when you look back at it, in them days, there weren't so many things as rotation. So for me, I took it personal, thinking, well, if he doesn't want me here. So I spoke to him a few times. Yeah, I got on really well with him. You could go knock on his door. He's one of them men, you can knock on the door, he'll sit you down, he'll have a good, honest conversation. He guaranteed, he said, no, you're going to play, you're going to play. And I said, oh, that's fine. Went back to training, and then all of a sudden I see all the things in the newspaper about Tottenham. So I went to see him again. I said, well, what's all this about Tottenham, you know? And then he came out and said, well, you know, I can't guarantee you're going to play all the time. And I think at the time, back in his mind, he was thinking an investment. So he said, I think it was 4 point something they were offering. So I think I then said to him, well, if it, you know, it's a chance for me to go back down south. And also, you know, financially, I'm going to earn more money. So there was different reasons why I wanted to go there. But at the same time, I would, if I even had turned it down, I'd have been happy to stay there because I was more than happy there. But, you know, he allowed me to go and speak to him. So and that's how it all turned out.
I'll bring Holland in, because I'll be rubbing it away. Sorry, Dave. Holland, I'll bring you in on a few of your questions you had for Raul.
Yeah, thanks, Raul. Yeah, being an Arsenal fan, Arsene Wenger came in 1996 and is regarded as him changing the culture of English football. That's what so they say. I'm wondering how it felt being at another club, and did it change the way things were done, i.e. the drinking culture? Did you notice a difference at other clubs once Wenger started implementing it in Arsenal?
Yeah, I think maybe that it started to change. I think even at Tottenham, we was training at it was a hellhole called Mill Hill somewhere up there, and it was just a Sunday Park place. It was like old changing rooms. You know, there was no door on the changing rooms. It was cold concrete. The showers didn't work. So we went from there to Alan Sugar was in charge of the club there. We went to a place called Chigwell, which is where I think they still are now, and that's when they built our own training ground. You had your own lockers, steam rooms. The doctor was on the premises. He had his own office there. We had a kitchen, so you could eat healthily there. So he had a massive input. I don't think he stopped the beer culture, but not at Tottenham anyway. I mean, the problem we had at Tottenham was that that's the only difference I felt was at Tottenham was socially we didn't really bond. We were just players. Where at Newcastle, we was told, no uncertain terms, we had to go out for lunch together all the time. Keegan would have a little golf trips away and make sure we all stayed together. Because it's like I said, at Norwich, I think that is a part and parcel of getting to know your players. But at Tottenham, it was all, you know, good players, great set of players individually. But as a team, you know, you've got one player, I lived in Colchester. You've got someone living in Brentwood. You've got someone lived in the West End. Someone lives, you know, Luton, you know, it was just, as soon as I finished training, everyone just scattered.
So I think that was down to the manager.
Yeah, no, it's down to the club culture, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, it's down to whatever manager you've got. He has a way of implementing and getting the team spirit there, because it don't always happen on the training ground. And I think, I think sometimes them little people skills, them little tricks that managers have, Keegan was brilliant at it. When I was at Norwich, they were brilliant at it. And when I went to Tottenham, even though we got on well, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the players I didn't like or whatever, but you never got to really know them. Apart from where there was an opening in the West End and a few of them turned up to it. But that was on a beer front. It wasn't, you know, like trips away where you could get to know each other, bonding things, you know. It was almost like you had to get to know each other on a pitch, and sometimes it just doesn't click. You could have we had a fantastic team. But it never clicked on a consistent basis, you know, where we kept building and building. So that I think that was maybe the slight difference when I was at Tottenham. Even though at times the football, I really enjoyed it and I loved being at Tottenham. I think as a personal thing for me, the team spirit wasn't quite there for me.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because unfortunately, I've got to go to work in a minute, but you just split them. Back your Tottenham days, you and David Ginola used to swap wings. Is that true?
Yeah, because we used to do that at Newcastle. It was just something naturally we started doing all the time. We've done it.
Yeah.
The manager didn't like it sometimes, but it was one of the things that you look at the way, I think something like Manchester United were the first ones to start doing things like that. And we learnt to do that at Norwich doing that because it was trying to think, it just gives you a different outlook. Because you remember, I think we can remember Giggs and Kanchelskis playing against us. And 1 minute you had him on the left wing, then Kanchelskis came over. Mm. So if you defend her, it's a nightmare. Because once you think, oh, I've got hold of this, I know what this wing is going to do. Now, next minute, you've got Ginola coming over. Yeah. You know, so we, as long as you've still done your defender's duties, I don't think it was a problem. You look at today's game now, where you play the three up front, it's almost the same thing. You know, you got players who interchange all the time.
That's a fantastic answer. Because when we done the underrated, we actually stuck you on the left wing. And we had a slight debate with certain listeners that were saying, Rule Fox played every one of his games on the right-hand side. But you've answered the question. It's fantastic to be right. I've got to sign out now. Let's go to
it. Rule, can I ask you, as an Arsenal fan, what it was like to play in a North London derby? I'd love to know how that was.
I didn't mind it. I mean, again, you got, like we said to you, for the fans, it's everything for the fans. Yeah. You know, I understand. I mean, I played in little ones. I mean, I played in a East Anglia derby, but I was playing for the wrong team in a way because I was from Ipswich and I was playing for Norwich. So I understood it because, you know, my family couldn't leave their house because they would just get bombarded all the time. Or, you know, if I lost, they'd be getting stick. Or don't forget, I was still actually living in Ipswich and playing for Norwich. So they knew where I lived. So I understood about the banter and, you know, the loyalty to things. So it was big. But again, I feel that even though it was big and it was built up big, I don't think the players kind of grabbed on of it. I think, you know, the foreign players took a while to actually understand the history of it. And I think, again, I think that's where you kind of missed a trick sometimes. I can remember, go back to Newcastle, I can remember when I went there, every player, we was all taken to like an old social club where all the fans go, you know, and we done a question and answer. Every player had to go, and you then understood what they had to pay to come and watch you. Then we went to see some of the old social clubs where the old guys had mining stories and all that, and, you know, and how hard it is, how much money they have to save up just to take their family to football. And it gives you a feel of what it means to the locals. But I think, with the Tottenham Arsenal thing, for the diehard fans like yourself, who's been brought up through family, you understand it, but it needs to be more instilled into the players. So they understand it. Because back in my day, I don't think we had to actually say anything about a derby. People were just kicking lumps at each other from minute one, you know. You'd be surprised if it was like an 8-a-side after 60 minutes. But that's what it meant to the players, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
But nowadays, I think, obviously, with the Vieira era, I think they bought into it because I think Wenger understood it more.
We did an episode again, the rivals between Arsenal and Man United, and one of the things that came up, we were saying that rivalry is important. I know you've got the derbies, and they are different to rivalries because of a longevity period. But the Man United and Arsenal was the last rivalry in football, in terms of English football, where you could have, when you had players playing for the club, you actually felt like they understood what it meant to the fans and to play for the club. So, you know, Keane versus Vieira, Gary Neville versus Overmars, Ian Wright, Schmeichel. It's lost now, I think. When you see players in the tunnel at halftime or during the game or before the game hugging and asking things about, do you think we've lost that now in the game? Do you enjoy... I mean, Keane's quite critical of it, and I think quite rightly so. What's your opinion on the way it's changed? It's quite a negative thing.
I think it's, like I said, that's the way that we're talking about, how we're going back to academies about, you know, you know, players not growing up quick enough. I think it comes down to that as well. Not telling me the quality of football is still good at times, but again, I think the passion isn't there. You know, they want to win the game, don't get me wrong, but sometimes it needs to be coming from the manager, how important this game is. You know, you always hear fans ranting on about it. You know, this means more. I don't care whether Tottenham are 10 points clear of Arsenal in the league. It's bragging rights. it's bragging rights. So it means so much. And I think when that's instilled into the players, you know, you'll get a passionate match. But nowadays, because players, again, I might be wrong, it might be the foreign input in that, where, you know, when they see each other, they're always giving someone a kiss on the cheek or shaking hands before games. But Alex Ferguson would never have that. He hated Arsenal and Wenger, they hated each other, but on a professional front, you know, they respected each other, but they knew that they were the top teams. And it's about trophies and winning and stuff. You know, you hear famously Alex saying, it's only Arsenal, you know, because he wanted to instill it into players, even though he knew they're a threat, he wanted to distill it and say, you know, they're not a threat to us. We just got to turn up. Don't let these people beat us. Don't let them beat us. So, you know, I love their manager rivalries. I'm not too sure whether, off the top of my head, I can think of a manager rivalry now.
Mourinho tries to rival everyone, doesn't he? But Mourinho, I think no one buys into the Mourinho anymore in terms of that mind games, all that stuff. It's kind of past.
Because all that psychological stuff, it worked when he had his first stint at Chelsea. Now people don't buy into it, you know, so it doesn't work so much. But the mind games used to work well, because don't forget, Mourinho's probably learned that because he saw Alex Ferguson do it. Because he was trying to win over Alex Ferguson when he first came to Chelsea, weren't he?
Yeah. Interesting seeing going to the mining clubs and things. A really important point. I would like to see more clubs, when it comes to a rivalry, they might do this. I might be speaking out of turn, but you don't really hear anything about it. Go into one of these places and seeing what the rivalry means to the fans, the real fans, you know. That, I think that's something that's... did that give you an extra edge? When you went to these things and you spoke and heard what the fans did, start thinking, God, I've got to win. I've got to make sure we get the free.
Yeah, well, what you do, you appreciate what they go through, because you're not a fan. So all you are is a player entertaining the fans. So it made you appreciate what it takes for them to actually come to a game. Or they'll give you their life stories of, you know, their dad's dad was a supporter, their granddad was a supporter. You know, as soon as their kids are bought, they're naming it after players in Newcastle. They're fanatical, you know. I had people bringing dogs to me to sign their dogs, and they're naming dogs after me and cats after you. It's mad. But then it makes you appreciate how fanatical. But again, it's also warming and nice, because there's always a story behind it. And they'll come up to you and they'll say to you, they want, you know, excuse me, love, let me say, you know, will you take my wife home and all that kind of stuff. And they're mad. But it's warming, but it's funny. But then that's the time, like you said, where you understood it, because you could go out in town. You know, every time we went out of town, we never had to buy a drink. But at the same time, we never thought we was too big for them. We never got hassled. We walk into a nightclub, they'll give us a standing ovation. They'll come and buy you a drink. You go behind a bar, they wouldn't let you buy a drink. They let your friends in. So you mingle with them. There was no jealousy, no one wanted to fight you. You know, anything like that. You were part of the community. And I think that's what makes that Newcastle so special.
Yeah, such a difference. Miller, you had a question? I'll jump back to you, Mills.
Since you've been talking, my mind's gone in loads of different avenues. When you was playing, I've heard certain players have superstitions, match day routines and stuff like that. Was there anything that you had to do on a match day to get your head straight?
There weren't nothing I did with my kit or anything like that. It was just music. I used to put music on, but then managers didn't like it sometimes because you forget to take it out and there's them doing the team talk. They might be telling me to pick up someone on the corner set piece, and I've got my music on. But I used to like that's when all the raves were going on when I was at Tottenham. Just when I went to Tottenham, that's when they used to have all the illegal raves and the garage and all that. So I was into all that stuff. So that used to get me going before a game. So if any ritual, I should always have music on. But nowadays, you see them on, they're coming off the coach with their big headphones on and all that now. But yeah, I only used to do that. It was after the warm-up. I'd have a little 5 minutes to myself, put headphones on and just rave myself up a little bit before a game. So that was my ritual.
So you're saying about changing sides where defenders would try and kick lumps at you and stuff like that. Would you say that's missing in today's game? Would you rather play in today's game where the referee protects you a bit more, or would you rather play in the era that you actually played in?
It's a bit of both, really, because I think you need to get the right balance. You don't want, you know, in my days, you're allowed to kick someone in the stands five times before you usually got a caution. So, you know, you as a bit of a marked man, I learned to hurdle quite early when I was a winger. Yeah. Don't forget, I'd play against people like Stuart Pearce and, you know, Freddie Benali and Julian Dix. So you had to learn to jump high. So, you know, my reflexes were very good. But at the same time, you know, if you give it back to him, then, you know, pick you up, shake your hand after a game. There was no animosity. Nowadays, because of the protection that players get, it encourages, it's get to the stage now where, you know, every week you see people diving. And even, you know, we could say it's a foreign influence, but even our own players are doing it. You know, even our own players are, you know, because they know now that they're being protected. So any sort of touch, you know, in a box or, you know, a lot of players now are quite clever at running across a defender and wait for the defender to climb with him and then falling over. You know,
it's more the screaming now, though. You have the screaming that you get because there's no crowds. It's almost like they've been shot.
I know. I saw the, I see the match of the day.
I saw that
with the Lacazette. And I heard it in the game. And I thought he broke his ankle or something. And when they replayed it, for me, imagine Vinnie Jones doing that to him. He's screaming. Because in my day, you could pick him up and drag him around for a little while. And then the referee would come in and you'd be able to give him a little dig. You know, nowadays they're screaming over just a little graze, and because they know if you scream now, that is a definite foreign thing, and it's not. I'm saying that they're cheated. It's the way that they've been brought up. It's the way they've been brought up. So to take that out of a player who's been brought up from a child, you know, to then come to our league when they're in their 20s, it's hard to get. It has to come from a manager again. It has to come from everyone saying, you know, you can't be diving. You know, famously Ronaldo had that when he was at Man United. Mm. And the players and Ferguson had to tell him, you can't keep doing it because, you know, that's not what they're about.
I think I'll say that the players, strong players in the change room will stamp that out. We don't do that in this country. We don't do it in this league, this club. But I don't think the clubs now have that strong backbone through the team.
It's winning games. That's the mentality. I mean, don't get me wrong. We had teams that were good enough to win major titles and European titles and stuff. What always let us down was that they would do anything to win a game.
Mm.
Well, we had our pride. Oh, we don't dive around with that. But then sometimes, you know, players would be diving around, rolling around, getting free kicks, and then that could be the winning goal. And then we might be angry, but when you get back home, when you look back now, you think, do you know what? You sometimes have to play them at their own game. But then where does the line start getting crossed?
That horse is bolted now. I think that diving tactically, it's tactical now. It's not a dive. It's a tactical play now. As you said, the forward will come across and wait for the defender, or he'll go in a box and wait for the defender to leave a leg in. So I think that's now, unfortunately, this is why we start with a 90s-based podcast, because you had the more characters, as Adam said, about the characters in the game. And as he said, we miss him, you know, Vinnie Jones, Dennis Wise, Roy Keane. You can go on and on and on and on about leaders in the game. Who is the player that you played with who was the best leader?
We don't really have Norwich so much because we was all together as a team. So something that we all kind of bundled in. I mean, leaders as in, like I said, like you say, a tough guy leader. We didn't really, at Newcastle, we had Barry Venison, who used to look after the players, any sort of trouble, he used to always be there. We had, even at Tottenham, I won't even call him a leader, but we had Colin Coleman. He was a nutter. He was an absolute nutter, but, you know, he weren't our captain because Sol was our captain, but he loved it. You know, he loved the rucks. He, you know, especially when it came to games, he'd be in the tunnel just barging past people sometimes just to start trouble, you know? I think that's the way he used to get himself up for a game. But for us, we're thinking, oh, what are you winding him up for? Do you know what I mean? Go past Roy Keane and give him a dig in the ribs when you walk. You don't need to wind him up. Do you know what I mean?
Proper shit ready. House.
yeah. But yeah, as in hard men, we, you know, you had your tough tackler midfield players, but we know our leaders were different. We had brave defenders. I mean, we had Ian Butterworth when I was at Norwich. He was a brave defender. But, you know, some people, they they lead by example. So they do their job, but they're not kind of people who are going to be grabbing people from here and telling you what to do, like a Keane, like we give an example. You know, some players lead. Sol Campbell's our captain, but he was never a vocal captain. He just led by his performances. Mm. You know, he was just such a good defender that, you know, we just all kind of learned off him, if you get what I mean.
Talking about Sol Campbell, how did that affect when he left Tottenham to go to Arsenal on that free? What was it like in the Tottenham squad?
I think it was more of a shock for the fans more than the players. Do you know, because you're around the players all the time, so it was going to happen. He was definitely going to leave, but it was also I'm room with him all the time. See, he was my room partner, so I had conversations with him all the time. And I you know what he was saying. Don't forget the team was depleted. Did we have Christian Gross at that time? But I can't remember if he was there.
Christian Gross, if you had him at the time, how was he as a manager?
Strangely enough, you know, I don't really have that many bad things. So do you know one thing I would give him credit for, which is a bit of an insult to us, but I think most players would agree. He was a little bit advanced coaching-wise for us. The only thing that let him down is that the players didn't buy into it because he was not really that well-known. And because the players didn't really feel him, and also the fans, he was always on a hider to nothing. But coaching-wise, training sessions, tactical things, he was very good. You know, he was a very good coach. But because you got to remember, when you got a new manager and he's not, I would say, that well-known, you kind of get away with giving him a little bit of back chat sometimes when you think training's rubbish or something. You know, where other managers, you just get on with a training session. No matter if they're good or bad, this manager's earned his stripes. So, you know, and he's been successful. Like when George Graham came in, no one was questioning his stuff, and his training wasn't the best. You know,
with Wenger coming in prior to that, though, that the players would have given him more of a chance to see what happened over across the road at Arsenal with a manager that was not well known with massive players. Do you not think that if everyone maybe banded together, maybe he could have been a more successful manager there?
I think if he had came in and he would have stamped his authority earlier, and any sort of players who would like back chatting and he put them in their place, then you're starting off on the right front. I think when you're trying to be too nice. And I think he was coming across nice to us, but all the stories we was hearing from when he was managing,
it was Grasshopper. I think
Grasshopper. He was totally different. You know, they were saying he was quite strict. He had a strict regime, and you know, about training, about how much running and stuff they were doing. But when he came up to Tottenham, he was also caught between wanting to implement all these ideas, but also wanting to kind of feel players out. But then by the time he started doing that, you know, players were, I wouldn't say they're not listening to him, but they didn't believe in what he was trying to put across. And then also what made it worse, I think Alan Sugar brought in Jürgen Klinsmann for the second time without Christian Gross knowing it. So it put Christian, you know, as far as Jürgen was gone, Jürgen was coming over to play football, but maybe with an option of coaching, I don't really know. But him coming over, you know, the press started leaking stories about him possibly taking over. And for a manager, he was probably thinking, well, how can I go against Jürgen Klinsmann? You know, he needed to get the dressing room, and I don't think he had the whole dressing room. So it was unfortunate for him. But, I've not really got too many bad things to say, because I thought he was a decent coach.
As you were saying about the playing at Tottenham, the level that you was in the league, was there any teams that you came up against where you thought, I know I'm going to have a good game against this lot? Or did you just have that one team or one player, like, don't want to name and shame anyone, but did you ever go on a pitch thinking, I'm going to have a field day on you today?
Yeah, Arsenal.
Yes.
Nigel Winterburn.
Yes, love that.
No, I'll be honest, I like playing against Nigel. They weren't that easy, really. There was players I liked to play against because it was competitive, but in a good way. You know, you enjoy playing. I couldn't really name. Could it be a little bit disrespectful to the players? Because I don't think players go out there. I think sometimes it's like saying to someone who's always getting the better of someone, you know, do you love playing? Of course, you like playing against certain teams. Mm. It's almost certain teams.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always done well against Coventry, and I couldn't even tell you who the left back was even then. See. So, but I enjoy playing them, not because I probably got the better level, because I always seem to perform well and score a goal. So you always had a team you could play well against. I because of my position, I enjoyed the battle with any fullback, even the difficult ones where against the hard ones like Pierce and that, you know, to just to get one over, even just get past Stuart Pierce once was a celebration for me. So, but yeah, I mean, even to that's what you play for, you know. That's why, you know, that's what you dream of. You know, people would, like they always say, rip off their right arm to be doing what I was doing, you know. So, you know, even the difficult games in a strange way was a learning thing for me, and it was also enjoyable.
At West Bromwich Albion, you ended your career playing for West Brom. What is that, because it was a bit of a supporter as well? It kind of was it did Mexico?
Yeah. It, you know, things always happen for a reason. It was just one of them situations that under George Graham, I come to the conclusion I wasn't going to be playing. I still had about a year and a half to run on my contract. They were hovering or hovering whether just to pay me off and let me go. Sugar didn't want to pay me off, so I was happy just to fight for my place. Then it was obvious they were. I think they had David Pleat came in as director of football. Then they were trying to get me to go because he kept telling me about all these clubs coming. He's telling me that Birmingham want me, Blackburn want, and I kept turning it down because I kept saying, "Well, no, you know, until I hear it from George Graham, then I wasn't going to go." So it kept going back and forth, and then threatening to, you know, just sell me. And I just said, "Well, you know, I'm at the end of my career. I was at 31." So I said, look, I'm going to go to a club I want to. And did that, the blue, Gary Megson, who I knew, who was at Norwich, while I was at Norwich, he was one of the, we go back to, you know, people who like to get stuck in. He was probably one of the key signers for us when we was at Norwich to being a bit more stable. Because when we was at Norwich, we were like Keystone Cops. We were just sprinting up the pitch and, you know, no one was getting back. He was one who kind of taught us, hold on, someone's got to sit. You know, he was the one who broke up play. So fair play to him. I've always respected him as a player, and he phoned me up and said to me, would you want to come to West Brom? Looked at the table of where West Brom was. I was thinking, yeah, do you know what? I was honestly hovering just to retire. I just kind of got that state of, I had enough. So he said to me, why don't you come up, have a look? At the same time, I think Blackburn, Sam Allardyce had phoned me up. Bolton, sorry, he was at Bolton. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said to him, oh yeah, I'll drive up and have a chat with you. As I'm driving up, Megson's on the phone to me, Fox, you can't go there, you don't want to go there, it's horrible, it's up north. He kept saying it. So in the end, I turned my car, drove up to West Brom, went up the M1 M6. I had Sam Allardyce's representative on the phone saying, you fucking bastard, we fucking got the hotel for you. Why aren't you fucking here? Blah, blah, blah. So I turned my phone off, went to West Brom in the end, spoke to him. And he just said to me, he said, look, he told me, he said, look, I know, you know, because he knew I was just really thinking of not playing no more. And he said, look, come here for a season. He go, you enjoy it? He go, look, you know, he said about me travelling back home. And so I won't be homesick, so I got extra days off. So he looked after me and he just said, look, I just want an experienced player in there. And he put me in a centre midfield, but he put me almost floating, you know, between the striker. And I loved it. You know, I wasn't made to do anything. I was at the age where I didn't want to be running around. So for me, I had, as well, I had two whippets up front. I had Lee Hughes, who was banging the goals, and Jason Roberts. So, yeah. And they were young lads. So for me, I had a, in a team where I was going to play all the time, I was probably captain, me and Derek McInnes, who's now Aberdeen manager.
Yeah.
So we had captain and vice captain. We had a really good team, you know. And so we had some really big, bullish players with Darren Moore, who's now manager of Sheffield Wednesday, was the size of him. We had him centre-half, you know. So we had a really, really good team. So, you know, all my job was to get the ball and give it to Lee Hughes and Jason Roberts.
Yeah.
So I became a bit of a false 10, whatever you want to call it. You know, I was just floating around.
You got that season as well, you got them to finish it that season as well, so we got promoted, but
it's still after that I still didn't have that feeling of work, because that obviously got the Premier and I thought, well, I'm not going to be playing. I'm 32, you know, and I had an extra year in my contract. I could have been playing, you know, got a coaching role, but I was honest with him. It got to the end of it, we, you know, for me to help them get promoted, you know, that was enough for me. And then I just said, well, no, that's it for me. I'm going to retire. So, yeah, it was a good way to finish. Like we said, the links with West Brom. It's ironic how things come round. You know, me being a supporter, Eddie McCurry at West Brom, meeting Cyril Regis as well, who was there. you know, yeah. Gory. So it was. I couldn't ask for a better ending to my career.
Amazing. And then obviously, we touched on international at the beginning, but you did play internationally for two games and scored one goal, which was a very good ratio. Tell us a bit about that. How'd that come around?
That was a strange one again, because after I actually finished playing football, I came back to my hometown, which I live at now, and I've always worked with the community here. So I started doing the helping them with the finances, and I was chairman down there. I played actually for my team I started at. So it all come around in a circle. So the Witten United team I started on as a kid, who I got spotted, I went back to them, was playing for them. Then I was playing for the vets. So I was just playing, and I got a call out of the blue from a guy who said he was coaching over in Montserrat, and said to me, they've invited you to go over there to my mother's home island to go do some training and coaching. So I thought, well, I spoke to my mum about it, and she just said, yeah, that would make her proud. So I thought, do you know what? I'm going to go over there. Ended up taking a flight out there, and I was doing that for 2 years, back and forth, and trying to find players. Ended up I was only supposed to be coaching, ended up playing in a tournament.
Yeah.
Playing in a tournament and scoring the goal, you know, which was great for me. So for me, it was probably one of my proudest times. It sounds strange, but for me to be able to play for my motherland, you know, it made my mum proud. Because I only played for the England B team, I was allowed to represent Montserrat, which was great. You know, I mean, they were just part-time players. One was a prison guard, someone was a chef. It was almost like you can pick your normal Sunday team with decent Sunday team. It was that level. We were like second from bottom in the world rankings. So after I went there, through my connections, I was able to bring some lower league players in, start to play some decent football. We then won our first game ever. And when we got back, there was a big carnival on for us just for winning the game. It was brilliant. That's where you realise what football means to people. You know, big carnival, you know, we got honoured as players and all that kind of thing. But then, like I said, as quickly as it went like that, the next stage for me was obviously to come back to England and try to, you know, do what the Jamaicans done and people like that, is see which heritage players had and bring them over. As soon as I'd done that, I knew at the time, but not a lot of people knew at the time, that's where all that corruption would start. We had all these lovely football associations, but for some reason they had no money. And I noticed quite a lot, because even though I told them specifically I didn't want no money, I said, all the money you give me my wages, I'll put it back to the team. And it was all dodgy things where I had to pick wages up from Trinidad at one time. So I had to get a flight over to Trinidad just to pick wages up, you know.
Alarm bells are ringing.
yeah, that's what I thought. I looked at my watch, I was like, you know what, it might be time for me to go. But yeah, that it was frustrating, but at the same time, again, it was a blessing, because I got out there, I got to see where my mother was from, you know, I saw family connections, I was able to coach them and get them to a higher level. We was off the bottom of the FIFA rankings and moved up 10 places. So for me, you know, it was a fantastic time. It's a pity how it ended, because I was happy to do it. I'm still happy to do it now. It was just a case they were going through, not their fault, because of the FIFA thing that was going on, Seth Blatter and a few of the others who were controlling the academy. There was just things dodgy going on. I couldn't really associate my name to it, because, you know, it was silly things like I would ask a player who I'd targeted from, for instance, I had a player called Tesfaye Bramble from Southend, and I knew the manager at the time, and I, you know, convinced him to come and play. And I was over in Montserrat at the time, and I, you know, phoned him up, told the association to book the tickets, and then I got a phone call from Heathrow saying that the association booked the tickets. So I had to pay for the tickets for three players to come over. And then when they got over there, they put me in hostels. They weren't like a hotel. Everything was just all kind of backwards.
Yeah.
And then after a while, I thought, well, you know, we didn't have a doctor. You know, we had a guy, an old guy in his 60s with a sponge. You know, so we just, do you know what I mean?
Was it a magic sponge?
Yeah. It was just prime, mate. And I just thought something's going to happen. I'm going to get sued. You know, you can't be asking professional players to come over and there's no doctor. You know, I've got a Southend Football Club phoning me up and saying, how's my player doing? And he's limping over off the other side of the pitch with an old guy with a bucket and a sponge. I'm saying, yeah, he's doing well. He's loving it over here. You know, so I had to quickly get out of that because I thought myself, unless they tightened up on stuff like that, it was kind of thing. Though it was an honour.
Brilliant. Fire round, basically ask you a few questions, just answer the first thing that comes to your head.
Yeah.
So first one, hardest player you played against?
Told you that. Stuart Pearce.
Stuart Pearce. Best game you ever played him?
I'd have to say the Bayern Munich game.
Most crazy player you played with?
Malcolm Allen. Do you don't want to ask me? You don't want to go into the story about that? Just believe me. All I'm going to say, there was a lot of sick players around at that time. I'll say him and Robert Flick.
Okay. Best manager you played under?
Oh, I know it's so strange. I'll have to give you two. Could obviously Mike Walker was the one who gave us a chance to play and enjoy ourselves, and then Kevin Keegan. So I say Mike Walker and Kevin Keegan.
Best goal you scored?
Oh, top of my head, against Ipswich. I was playing for Newcastle. I scored against Ipswich. They were booing me all game. And I smashed one in from 23 yards in the top corner.
I was waiting for you to say a goal against Arsenal there, Rule.
No.
Last question, Rule.
A couple of them.
Best player you played with?
Again, there's so many. Not trying to disrespect players. I could go Ginola, I could go Teddy Sheringham, I could go Les Ferdinand, Peter Beardsley, Andy Cole. You know, there's so many. But I think if I'm looking for Ian Crook at Norwich, I think if I look for an all-round player who was unselfish, but he could win games for us just from something magical, Peter Beardsley.
Fantastic. Raw, thank you so much. I'd love to have you back.
It's been a pleasure, guys.
I'd love to have you on
anytime, guys.
Where we've got an actual topic and bringing things. I think you, the knowledge that you've given and the way you answer so eloquently on the questions, absolute credit to the game, an asset for the podcast. No, thank you so much, Mr. Rule Fox.
Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.